Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It takes a complicated and uncompromising woman to be caricatured as a Lady Macbeth by both the KGB and the writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Yet that is exactly what Elena Bonner was, a complicated, uncompromising Soviet dissident who came to the world's attention through her husband, the Nobel Prize-winning nuclear physicist Andrei Sakharov.
Elena Bonner died Saturday of heart failure. She was 88. She was living in Brookline. Here she is last year speaking through a translator to the BBC about accepting the Nobel Prize in 1975 on behalf of her husband, who was prevented by Soviet authorities from traveling to Oslo.
By awarding the Nobel Prize to Andrei Dmitrievich Sakharov, Russian dissident and Russian scientist, the international community were forced to look closely at what was happening in Russia, and in particular, what was happening to the group of people known as dissidents.
Well, joining us now is Josh Rubenstein. He's the Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International, USA, and he's the author of a number of books on the Soviet dissident movement, including The KGB File of Andrei Sakharov. Josh Rubenstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
So we mentioned that Elena Bonner was best known as the wife of Andrei Sakharov, but tell us how you first got to meet her.
Well, I met her most certainly in 1985, when she came here. She'd been in Gorky, and under pressure from Sakharov, the regime let her out, and she got medical care here. But I was in touch with the family from 1977 on, when her daughter Tatyana Yankelevich and her son Alexei were allowed to leave in 1977 in order to escape harassment and persecution.
And how is it that she got involved in the Soviet dissident movement? I mean, did it predate her marriage and partnership with Sakharov?
Absolutely. Keep in mind, she's from a generation that suffered firsthand under Stalin. Her father was arrested during the Great Purge of the 1930s and executed. Her mother spent 17 or 18 years in the Gulag. So when Khrushchev was removed from power in October of 1964 and his reforms were reversed, many people came forward to defend those reforms, and that was the beginning of the Soviet human rights movement, and she was part of that. And then she took on the cause of political prisoners, and that's what brought her into contact with Sakharov when they met in 1971, and they married in January 1972.
Now, her father, as you mentioned, he was the founder of the Soviet Armenian Communist Party.
Well, he was an Armenian. He was very involved in the communist movement in that part of the country. So she came from a family of true believers, and of course, they suffered for that under Stalin. That was a very common and tragic aspect of life under Stalin.
And in the Second World War, I mean, she was involved in fighting the Nazis, the Soviet losses being almost incalculable in the Second World War.
Yes, well, she was injured twice, and it left her with very severe eye damage, and she often needed eye care, surgery, and other procedures, and that was one of the things that led Sakharov to come to her defense, even to have hunger strikes to compel the regime to allow her to go to Italy to seek medical treatment.
Now, what exactly was it that turned her, I don't want to say necessarily against communism, but against the Soviet regime?
Well, she understood it was a repressive regime, it was corrupt, and like many people, she began to speak her mind in the 60s when it became possible. It wasn't under Stalin, and after Stalin's death, there were so many other things happening, and the regime did relent, but after Khrushchev was removed and then the invasion of Czechoslovakia in the summer of 1968, that gave people tremendous moral impetus to speak up. Mm. And she was part of that wave of dissent.
You know, it's very fascinating to me when people ride this crest of history, who choose to become dissidents of some kind, because not everybody does. Obviously, only a very small number do. And, you know, in reading the obituaries of Elena Bonner, she's written as being this woman who said she would have rather have been a babushka, wasn't really seeking to be a political activist of any kind. So what kind of woman was she? Like, when you met her, How did she strike you?
Well, look, she was a very determined woman, very intelligent, devoted to literature and then to politics. Obviously, the circumstances compelled her to speak up, and in that situation, you become a dissident. But it's true, not everybody can do it. You have to have a peculiar kind of character to risk so much on behalf of others. She lived a privileged life. She was a doctor in that context. Here was Sakharov, among the most honored Soviet citizens. He gave the regime the hydrogen bomb. They never understood why he became a dissident. They couldn't understand that, as a matter of principle, he didn't like the regime. He didn't like it that you had political prisoners, that you had torture, that you had Siberian exile. He wanted to speak up for democratic values. They couldn't understand that. They thought he was under her influence, or they thought he felt guilty for helping to design the hydrogen bomb.
Hmm. How is it that Elena Bonner came to Brookline in particular?
Well, her daughter and son came to Boston in the late 70s. Tatiana has lived here since that time. So obviously Elena Bonner wanted to be with her family, with her children, with her grandchildren. And there's also a large emigre community here of people whom she could befriend, who helped her out. So it's not that she recreated her life in Moscow. She wasn't interested in doing that. But she never learned English, and she had a strong cadre of friends here in Boston to support her. So it was natural she would live here.
Hmm. I wonder, Josh Rubenstein, if we could step back a little. In hearing these stories about this, you know, this very famous woman, prominent Soviet dissident, who Elena Bonner passed away at 88. It almost seems like a world ago.
Well, it is a world ago, not only because she is one of the few remaining dissidents from that era. There are others in Moscow and here, by the way. But because the Soviet regime is now gone for about two decades.
And yet I wonder did she ever speak to you about the Russian government as it is today?
She is well known for criticism of Vladimir Putin, for her profound disappointment that the goal of establishing democratic values, democratic reform in today's Russia has virtually been abandoned by the political leadership. And she was profoundly disappointed in that.
Mm. Anyway, as you were saying, I didn't mean to interrupt you there,
yes.
But the fact that the Soviet Union as an entity, as a nation, no longer exists, and yet the work of dissidents such as Elena Bonner seems to still be of resonance. And why do you think that is?
Well, it's of resonance because the democratic values they defended under the Soviet regime still need defending in the post-Soviet era, because democracy is fading in Russia, because you have a more and more authoritarian government. You have attacks on journalists. You have the assassination of journalists. You have these two useless wars in Chechnya, which she opposed, both under Yeltsin and then under Putin. And so her values remain the same, just as our values remain the same. But the circumstances changed. That didn't make it any less compelling for her to speak up. But she was in Boston. She was older. Her health was failing. So she wasn't going to be visiting prisoners or the families of prisoners, but she could still circulate essays and speak her mind.
Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International and author of The KGB File of Andrei Sakharov, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And it's time now to take a look at your feedback from our recent programs.
Last Tuesday, we talked about the questionable recruitment tactics and loan policies for some for-profit colleges and universities. Deanne Lunin, attorney at the National Consumer Law Center, expressed her concern over the high rate of student defaults at for-profit institutions and schools.
Our biggest concern really is the harm that causes to students who don't succeed at the schools, either because they're not getting jobs or they're not completing the programs, and in those cases are saddled with very high levels of student loan debt.
Listener Steve, who told us that he taught for for-profit colleges, says these colleges treated their students like customers and didn't always hold them to high academic standards. When there were conflicts over grades or other classroom matters, Steve writes, the student was always right.
On Thursday, we discussed how new fathers are increasingly struggling to balance work and being an involved parent. We looked at a new study from Boston College's Center for Work and Family. Listener Kevin Neusman was surprised that we used the terms paternity and maternity leave rather than the gender-neutral term parental leave. He suggested the idea of maternity and paternity leaves is outdated, and that men and women have the same standing under the law for parental leave benefits.
Under the law, perhaps. But the fact is, Kevin, while many companies offer paid maternity leave, very few offer paid paternity leave. On Friday, we talked with Red Sox fan Francie LaTour about why we don't see more blacks at Fenway Park. In part, LaTour blamed radio hosts Dennis and Callahan as being unfriendly to African-American fans.
But listener JDancer7 says these guys are not typical Boston fans. They are over-the-top horror shows, JDancer7 writes. I don't know why NESN lets them on the air, which I think was Francie's point exactly.
Last week, we also took a look at the darker side of young adult literature. Listener Betty Ann Sharp reminds us that it wasn't until the mid-1800s that we started producing literature specifically for children. And if we consider the fantasy worlds of zombies and vampires to be too dark, Betty says consider what young adults read in past centuries. She writes that as early as 1799, books and pamphlets published for children preach damnation of your immortal soul if you fail. Zombies and vampires are perhaps not so scary after all.
Listeners, we are always happy to hear from you, so please keep your comments, questions, criticism, and praise, even if you want, coming our way. You can find all the ways to contact us at radioboston.org.
Stay with us. Up next, today's talker, how the rapper Eminem entered one seventh grade classroom and how it may have cost one teacher her job. We'll ask for your opinion. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.